You're listening to The Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. And our guest today is Andrea James. She's founder of Families for Justice as Healing in Boston, Massachusetts. She was a Soros Justice Fellow in 2015, and she's author of the book Upper Bunkies Unite and Other Thoughts on the Politics of Mass Incarceration. I'm going to let her tell her story rather than try to summarize or even really introduce it too much, because it's one of those stories that you have to hear in some detail and let it sink in. So what I would say is, for the duration of this program, just imagine walking in her shoes, especially if you've never been to prison yourself or known somebody who was in prison. Just really go there with her. I think that what she's talking about is important information for us to know as citizens and residents of a country that has yet to live up to a lot of its ideals. And at the same time, I think it's important for us to feel these stories in a personal way, which Andrea James gives us the opportunity to do. By the way, she's going to be coming out with a podcast of her own soon. I will let listeners know about it when that happens. Welcome, Andrea James.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Wonderful to be speaking with you.
Great to be speaking with you. Your work on mass incarceration challenges some really basic ideas in our society, and I feel like it brings into focus our dark side as a country. Tell us a little bit about your story. You grew up in a family of activists in Boston, Massachusetts, in Roxbury. You became a criminal defense attorney. First of all, how did you decide to choose law as a profession?
One of my family heroes was a lawyer. My mother's brother, Reginald Alleyne, was one, I believe he was the first black tenured law professor at UCLA, where he taught for more than 25 years. He also was a labor lawyer, premier labor lawyer in this country, and was an incredible human being. And he was a constitutional law expert. I grew up listening to him and hearing his thoughts on the Constitution and the law that defined it. And I was intrigued. I was interested early on in the field of law because of him mostly, but then I grew up in a community that was heavily affected by legal matters and the war on drugs. And I had the real privilege of attending a very elite private school here in the East Coast. And I just saw two very different trajectories for young people who did things that young people everywhere do, regardless of race and regardless of socioeconomic background. And because of the unique upbringing that I had, coming from the incredible family that I was raised in, and having the privilege of being educated where I was educated and having all the life experiences that come along with that, but also staying in a predominantly African-American, working class and poor community that was heavily under the oppression of some bad policies, I got to see up close and personal very early on in my life that changes needed to happen. And I, because of the influence, and I knew very early that lawyers existed and what they were there for, I decided I wanted to become a criminal defense lawyer because I thought that at the time that that was the best way to contribute to creating the change.
And you practiced law and you were an activist. And then at one point you made, let's call it, a serious error of judgment that landed you in federal prison with a 2-year sentence. You'd already been working with prisoners. What did you find out that you hadn't known before when you were suddenly on the inside?
Oh, gosh. I didn't think there was anything anybody could tell me, anything more that anybody could tell me about how broken the system was from all of my personal experiences in my community, growing up in my community, becoming a criminal defense attorney. I walked into a prison now, not as a lawyer, but as an incarcerated woman. And that experience just rocked me to my core to see women predominantly there for drug convictions who I had to figure out how to navigate through 24 months, sentence in a prison that was in another state, 3.5 hours away from my husband and my children. These women that I found myself incarcerated with had been there for 24 years. They were there due to drug convictions. They did not need to be there. It was a colossal waste of money. It was a colossal waste of human potential. And it was did nothing but cause further harm and disruption in the lives of these women, in the lives of their children, and in the lives of all the people that lived in the communities that these women were coming from. And these women were predominantly African American and Latino women coming from everywhere, urban USA, with an increasing influx of poor white women coming from more rural communities and coming in for the same things that black women had for decades been sentenced around the crack laws. These white women were now coming in with meth convictions for methamphetamine. And it was the same situation, poor people, poor women with children, separated, many of them struggling with the illness of addiction. And to see this up close and personal, it's one thing to stand in a courtroom and to defend people. It's one thing to be in a community where you know people all the time who are being cycled in and out of incarceration. But when you actually go and live in a prison where you see where those people go when they're disappeared from our communities, being on the other side, you know, of that prison wall where you're at the receiving end of where these people are disappeared to, you become acutely aware of what's happening in this country, who's being targeted for it, and how wrong it is.
Yeah. The book is called Upper Bunkies Unite, and it refers to the fact that you slept on the top bunk. And it's a shocking book. I mean, even for people who have educated themselves on prison conditions in the U.S., the first thing they did was subject you to the humiliation of a strip search. And then you had an orientation in which they said to you, don't act like an inmate, act like a convict. Explain that.
Well, and there's a whole movement going on in the country. I'll just start off by saying that to even stop the use of the word inmate because of how it is used to dehumanize and to demoralize us inside of the prison, and that it becomes, we're still, if you look at a lot of articles that are written today, former inmate and ex-convict, these are all terms, they're all the same, that are used to dehumanize us. They create a stigma within us and psychological barriers that make it very difficult, even after your release, to overcome those labels. And what it also does is those types of labels, whether it's either inmate or convict, and I'll get to what she was referring to, the person in the prison administrator who said that to us, but all of those labels are used to create a subclass of people, because when we write those types of descriptions of people into policy and into legislation, into the things that control and determine what policy should look like, it's more okay for people who have not been directly affected by this. They feel more comfortable if they think that, oh, we're only talking about somebody who's an inmate or somebody who's a convict. And so we have this movement going through the country that's been started by Eddie Ellis, who died not too long ago, but was adamant, formerly incarcerated man, who was adamant about us not forcing people to not refer to those terms. So that's one thing I just wanted to mention. But what she was referring to is, you know, again, using these terms. Everybody inside of the prison is considered an inmate. They call us inmate. They don't call us by our names. You become a number and a name. That is what we become once you become an incarcerated person. What she was referring to is a convict, which she was trying to say is somebody who is a, you know, hardened to the life of being incarcerated. And if she punishes one of us for doing something or whatever she doles out to us, she was telling us, don't just be an inmate, be a convict. Take it like a convict, meaning you're strong, and no matter what anybody does to you in here, as far as the administration goes, whether they take your phone calls from you for punishment so you can't call your children, or take your visits from you so that you can't see your children or your family, an inmate would complain about that. A convict, according to her, is somebody that would just say, well, that's the life of being a convict in prison. I'm just going to keep going.
You name a few people inside the prison who treated you like a human being, but for the most part, they dehumanized you and the other women who you were there with, and you describe things like, they wouldn't give you soap, so you had water but no soap to wash. They took away the microwave so you couldn't heat your food. And they even took away your blankets on one of the coldest nights of the year in an uninsulated building. All this was happening in Danbury, Connecticut, Connecticut being supposedly a progressive state. And it really brings up the question of prisoners' rights. What rights, if any, do prisoners have, and how do they go about getting those rights actually enforced?
Well, really, the fact of the matter is that you have no rights, and you're not considered somebody that has constitutional protections once you become incarcerated, for the most part. Incarcerated people just don't have rights. So there's no, we have a right to unreasonable, you know, protection against unreasonable search and seizure, right? That doesn't exist in, when you're incarcerated. They can come into your living area, into your room, or into your cell. They can toss things, look through your stuff. Do whatever they want to do at any time. They can search you, strip you, do body cavities, have you remove feminine hygiene things such as tampons to prove that you're not concealing contraband. And the truth of the matter is that, and it's, this is just fact. It's not, we're not pointing fingers at corrections officers, but the majority of the drugs that enter the prison do not come from incarcerated people and their visitors. They come from corrections officers and staff who are making money bringing contraband into the prison. But people who are incarcerated are subjected to all of these things. So you really, you don't have any rights. You're told what to do and when to do it. You lose your identity, as I said. You don't have a right to a visit. They can cut you off at any time. You don't have a right to make a phone call. It's a privilege. And they can shut the phones off at any time. So you really have no rights. I mean, it has to be something incredibly egregious for you to be able to challenge something through a court system, but even that has to go through what are called administrative remedies first. So administrative remedies are the remedies that you apply for through the Federal Bureau of Prisons and their policies for how to challenge grievances. And then if that grievance is not resolved from within the prison, you can then carry it once you hit that ceiling for the administrative process. Then you can petition a court to hear your case. That takes a excruciatingly long time. There are organizations such as the ACA, which is the American Correctional Association, that their purpose is supposed to be to oversee and be a watchdog of prisons and to take the grievances, not so much the grievances, but the complaints or the things that people are bringing to the attention that they should be checking the prison on. But the fact of the matter is that prisons pay the ACA to get their accreditation. So anybody who's in the business of selling something isn't going to tell somebody, I don't want you to buy it from me. That's not how capitalism works in this system. So that didn't work too well. So we did try at one time to challenge the fact that we had no soap in the bathrooms, and the ACA posted that they were coming to do an inspection, and that's when they force us all in the prison to clean the prison, and they give us cleaning supplies that we don't normally have, and we're forced to all scrub and clean and spit polish this prison when the ACA is coming for their annual inspection. We're not allowed to speak to them, although we asked. And then the administration is forced to post a notice in the hallway of the prison, throughout the prison, letting us know that the ACA is coming in case there is an issue we want to bring to their attention. But when we tried to do that, and we also requested the ACA's guidelines for what are the things that prisons must provide, because we were pretty sure that soap had to be in there, we were told that we could not get a copy, but we could purchase one. And of course, none of us had $90 to purchase the book. And so we went without it. And the camp administrator, when I continued to ask him, finally allowed me to schedule an appointment to come to his office. He would not give me the book to read so that I could look up what we were looking for in terms of our grievances. But he said, ask me something and I'll read you the policy. I'll read the policy back to you, which was ridiculous. Right. And so that's, you know, your rights are nil. And one of the reasons is that nobody cares. So there's nobody on the outside that's paying close enough attention to what's happening on the inside. There's no transparency there. And the prison is allowed to keep up this facade that for security purposes, certain things can't happen, such as people coming in and talking to incarcerated women about what the conditions are, what are their needs. Those things don't happen a lot. More and more they are happening now. And I do think it's because incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women have started to use their voices loudly to talk about their experiences prior to incarceration, during incarceration, and the challenges of post-incarceration.
I want to read a little paragraph from your book. You were talking about the women who were there, and you said, most of us having made a mistake after entire lifetimes of playing by the rules, raising our families, walking a straight line, voting, PTA meetings, volunteering, feeding the hungry, and clothing the homeless, and so on. And you just basically talk about, you know, these are people who go to church or meditation. And you end the paragraph, you say, everyday people, kind and caring people, serving unreasonably long sentences for choices made trying to exist as ordinary people with too few resources. And I feel like that kind of sums it up. I mean, what we're looking at is the result of very deep inequality. And then you've got people saying to you, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. How do you respond when people say that?
Well, I mean, first of all, a lot of things that people are incarcerated for, particularly women, aren't crimes at all. They shouldn't be crimes. They've been turned into crimes in our kind of push to become more hard on crime in this country. We are the most incarcerating country in the world. And you can put all the countries outside of the United States together and we still would have more people incarcerated just here in the United States. And that's because we've taken this approach that everything, every mistake that a person makes first should be met with heavy prosecution and figuring out how do they need to be punished. So we have taken on this ideology in this country that is a punishment ideology. And that's bad, you know, because if you look at the life, for instance, of an incarcerated woman on that bunk, and you just start to peel back what she's gone through that led her to that prison bunk, these are all things, for the most part, that people should not be sent to prison for. We have a crisis in this country now of addiction, and certainly addiction is a public health issue. We are just beginning to recognize it as a public health issue more recently because white middle class kids are being increasingly affected by the opioid crisis and falling into off that cliff into addiction, which is horrific for any group of people to have to endure. It's a horrific experience for anybody. But when there were poor Black and brown people who were struggling with the illness of addiction starting back in the 70s with heroin. We had a horrific heroin epidemic in the urban communities back in the 70s after the Vietnam War. That was a result of that war. And that was met with fury. That was met with the Nixon administration and going forward with administrations that hammered away at needing a hard on crime posture around the illness of addiction and drugs. And so that was targeted towards poor communities of color. And as a result, we see the disproportionate impact that those policies have had. It's not a situation where, you know, people aren't necessarily really paying attention to this factor. And now that the opioid crisis has kind of, you know, come back on all of us, it is affecting communities that are now desperate to get their children, their children and their adult young people in their households, the help that they need, understanding that it's an addiction that has dramatically and in a negative way changed the lives of their loved ones. And so, you know, that wasn't the case. And so there was a targeting of communities of color. And here we are.
You said a moment ago that the heroin addiction crisis in the 1970s was a direct result of the Vietnam War. And I want you to talk about that for a second, because I think a lot of people understand that in poor communities of color, there's a lack of opportunity and people can make money selling drugs. And it's like its own kind of capitalism, essentially, that's happening on a street level and has a whole hierarchy and all of that. But what I think is less understood is why people take drugs. So, like, starting with Vietnam as an example, talk about that.
Well, and addiction wasn't my issue. I wasn't addicted to drugs, and that's not what sent me to prison. But I certainly have been in a community, lived in a community that was heavily under siege by the drug war and illness of addiction. And I've been in prison with a number of women who struggle and suffer. And I have, you know, outside of this interview, because you're speaking to me, I would have referred you to somebody who actually had that direct experience. But the fact of the matter is that the majority of people in this country that use drugs aren't people that fall off that cliff into addiction, first of all. Let's just say that, okay? Yeah. We have a demand for drugs in this country that is insatiable. And so that comes from our college campuses. That comes from recreational drug use. Let me put it that way, okay? And so we have the majority of people in this country that have kept the demand high for drugs are people who are doing recreational drug use. And so because of that, and then one day they wake up, they either age out of it, they get older, they have a kid, they graduate from college, they get into that first job or something that makes them say, you know what, I'm kind of getting too old for this. I don't want to do this anymore. Forget it. Let me put my party days down. And the recreational drug use is over. And as we know from the brilliant doctors and PhD folks like Dr. Gabor Mate and Kyle Hott, brilliant, brilliant people that have worked with people struggling through the illness of addiction. They know that, you know, you can have two brothers from the same household with the same parents, and one brother goes off and goes to Harvard and becomes a national commentator on national TV, and the other brother finds himself, due to the illness of addiction, struggling and incarcerated, serving a life sentence for something.
Yeah.
Same family. It's because there are building blocks to addiction, and trauma plays a huge role in that. And trauma is different for everybody. It's defined different for everybody, and trauma is just different for everybody. People can have the same experience, but it be completely traumatic for one and not so much for the other. And that trauma is that piece that, in addition to just using drugs, can, and I'm giving you a very simplistic, non-scientific, I don't know what I'm talking about in terms of that, but just what I've read, that pushes that person off that cliff into the illness of addiction. Okay. And so there's a lot of people using drugs who will just stop when they get ready to stop and just go on with their lives. And then there's that percentage of people that fall off that cliff into addiction. And so, and that is because there is something that they are trying to heal from or to escape from. And particularly with women, more than 90% of incarcerated women have histories of sexual trauma in their lives. And many times that sexual trauma has started as children. And so you have women, and you have girls, incarcerated girls, all of the incarcerated girls. You go into a child's prison, and the girls who are there all can tell you stories of having been sexually abused in some way. Domestic violence, you know, these issues run as a common thread in the lives of incarcerated women. And as a result of that, many of them turn to drugs as a way to cope, as a way to deal with very difficult experiences, life experiences that they have had. And it's really quite sad that in this country, we believe that the best way to respond to somebody who is causing harm because of the illness of addiction, and that we think that the way to solve that is to put them on a prison bunk where the addiction is never addressed, never addressed. If it is addressed, and don't believe the hype, if it is addressed in a prison, those programs, they take forever to get into, and they don't last. They're a blip on the screen. And if you're in a prison like a federal prison, you can't even take the drug program. Not everybody is eligible for it. And if you do get lucky and get a slot in there, you're only eligible for it, say, if you're serving a 10-year sentence, which so many women in federal prison are serving 10-year mandatory minimum sentences. they are not eligible for RDAP, which is the drug program, until they're scheduled to be close to release, which is pretty much within a year from their release date. So you sit in a prison for 10 years. You're struggling with the illness of addiction. And that's only if you're lucky. I sat and talked with women who, after 10 years of being in prison, they know, just knowing that they're about to be released, and they describe it as the drug is calling them.
Yeah.
So they've never received any treatment. And now they're crying because they've lost 10 years of their lives. They've lost their children. They've lost any hope. But at the same time, they have not learned any skills to help them cope with their illness. And they're not provided any medicated assisted treatment. And they're about to go back out. And the one thing that is heaviest on their mind is getting high.
Yeah.
That is insane. And those are the things that, when you asked the question in the beginning, that I would not have known. I always say, you know, I was a professional in the criminal justice system as a criminal defense lawyer, and I had always worked in the system in some capacity prior to going to law school. I did not become an expert until I became an incarcerated woman and actually saw the outcomes of the policies that we currently have in place in this country. The bad outcomes.
Plus, a lot of what happens to women who are in prison is that they're mothers and they can't care for their children. And the majority of them have children. And the stories you tell of that, I mean, it is the deepest wailing primal grief. I mean, it's heartbreaking. You had a small child, a baby, when you went in, and you were, you know, relatively one of the lucky ones because you weren't serving a long mandatory minimum sentence. Tell us the stories of some of the mothers that you witnessed.
Oh my gosh. You know, I'll never forget. I was, had just come into the prison, and my son was 5 months old when I had to leave him. And my youngest daughter at the time was 12. It was heart-wrenching. I can't, you know, I live with that. It's trauma in my life of that separation from my children and leaving my 5-month-old newborn baby. And it was just a terrible, horrible. I mean, it breaks me up to think about it now. There's a heaviness in me that will never leave me from that experience. And I'm back with my children, and my husband brought my children every single weekend, no matter what, snowstorms, blizzards. He brought them for 2 years to make sure that my children knew who I was. And my son kind of didn't really know who mommy was, but he knew I was the mommy lady. Right. So, and he was 2 years old when I came home. And so that is an experience. That's time that I'll never get back with him. And it was heart wrenching even to think about it today. And there are times when I remember a woman in the prison asked me, wanted to make a little crochet thing for my son. And she said, "Well, what size is he?" And I broke down. I was standing at the sink, the common sink out in the hallway, washing a dish. And she said, "What size is he now?" And I, in an instant, I realized I could not, as his mother, I did not know what size clothing my son wore. But these women, you know, I remember that maybe the first 2 weeks that I was in the prison, you're sent to this large room that has just bunks everywhere. The lights never go off. It's bedlam. It's crazy. And some of the women who are punished, who have permanent, are in the permanent housing part of the prison, they're punished by losing their permanent space, and they're sent back into this kind of transition space called the bus stop. We refer to it as the bus stop because people come and go all day, all night. And that's where you're sent until you finally wind your way through this system of getting to a permanent space where you, for the first time, it's just you and one of your bunkies or cellmates or roommates. And you're able to kind of get some peace of mind, not peace because it's never quiet, but peace of mind because you now have this cubicle kind of built around you to give you a limited amount of privacy. So until that, yeah, I remember looking over, and this woman who had been punished had been moved from one side of the prison back over into the bus stop where we all were as the new girls, as we were called. And she opened her locker door. And there was this succession of pictures, of photographs, of her looking much younger. And she's holding the hand of these two little boys. They might have been 7 and 9 at the time. And we couldn't keep pictures outside any thing. We had locker doors, and everybody put their children's pictures inside of the locker doors. And as you've gone along her door, the kids got bigger. And then there's the last picture was a picture of her now in present time. And she's holding a little newborn baby. And then these two grown men are standing next to her. Well, those two grown men were the two little boys that were in that first picture. Those were her sons when she first came to prison. Yeah. And in the last picture, she's holding this baby in her arms. That's her grandchild. And her two grown sons are standing on each side of her. And this is a woman who was in Danbury serving a federal drug sentence. And so the horrific and barbaric and absolutely unjust and disgusting lengths of sentences that people are given on a drug case is outrageous. And there were women, every woman in that prison, except for a small handful of us who were there, as most of us who were there for money offenses had been professionals who had crossed the line in a bad way. And there were just a handful of us in there. Everybody else was in there for a drug offense that they were convicted of, mostly because of conspiracy, which is a whole nother kettle of fish. But conspiracy is a catch-all net. But for conspiracy laws and the way that prosecutors wield them, we would not have federal prisons crammed full of women that did not deserve the sentences they received. But because they were caught in this net called conspiracy, they were dragged into the conspiracy, not charged based on their individual actions, but they were used to get testimony out of or to squeeze them. And if they wouldn't do everything that the prosecutors wanted them to do or couldn't do everything because they didn't know anything, they were just charged under the conspiracy law. And then when you're sentenced as if you were the kingpin. It makes no differentiation about whether you were the kingpin or you were the girlfriend of somebody who was selling drugs.
So a lot of these people were basically girlfriends who knew or sort of knew what was going on. And their crime essentially was not telling the cops on their husbands or boyfriends.
Or brothers. In the feds, you had three generations, grandmother, mother, and daughter locked up together. If you ask them, where's your male counterparts from your family? The father, the brother, the uncle are in federal prison somewhere in the country. None of the trusted adults in these families. We're working on a case right now supporting this woman around this very instance. She's been charged under the drug conspiracy laws and dragged into a drug ring. And her husband as well is a co-defendant in that same case. And they are both facing 10-year sentences. So it's real. I mean, and when you have communities where, you know, my experience growing up and having the privilege of being in all of these other types of communities where some of the most wealthiest people I went to school with as a child and as a teenager, and wealth beyond anything that I could have imagined if I hadn't had the experience of being in this elite school. And their lives, when it comes to drugs, aren't any different than other people's lives. It's just that they're wealthy. And if they fall off that cliff, people are there to catch them. Their resources are there. Prison is never an option. It's just not on the table. They go and they go away. They get rehab time and time again. They're allowed to repair and fix and repair their lives and get back on track. And they graduate and they go off to schools like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and these places that people that go to those elite schools get to attend, as opposed to some poor black kid who's in the community who falls off that cliff. He's going into juvenile and then he's going off to prison. Yeah. That is the response. And so I guess I just had a life experience that allowed me to see this in a way that just made me understand. When I walked into that prison and saw a sea of black women and heard their stories and met their families as they came up to visit and saw their children, or didn't meet them, but saw the pictures of their children and heard the horror that they had not even laid eyes on their children for 6 and 7 years because they were women from Compton or from Houston or from Detroit or from Chicago or from any urban hub anywhere across this country. And they didn't have the means. Their families didn't have the money, or they lost their children. The last time they saw them, they were looking out of the back of a law enforcement vehicle, staring, watching some other law enforcement person shuttling away their children. That was 7 years ago, and that was the last time they laid their eyes on them. I mean, what kind of country does that?
Yeah. And this, I mean, this has been going on since the beginning of our country, since before. I mean, this is a political drama that's been going on since slavery. And it's, I mean, it's the dehumanization of one group or class of people for the gain of another. And this current wave of mass incarceration has been going on for, you know, at least the last 30 years or so. We know who's losing because you've described it in some detail. Who's benefiting?
Well, clearly a lot of people aren't benefiting as they thought they would in terms of the, you know, the cost of this. It's why, you know, the states, particularly a lot of the red states started to push back on this hard on crime policy. It wasn't because they gave a darn about the people that were being, you know, warehoused in these prisons. It's about their lives. They didn't care about that. And the political ideology, the political agenda now of many of the still conservative people in this country aren't political agendas that care about the well-being of poor people. But certainly they ran into a situation where states were just drowning under the debt and the cost. I mean, upwards of 70% of state budgets were spent on locking people up. And so state after state after state started to say, wait a minute, we can't, you know, this whole idea that Clinton pushed out in the 1990s crime bill, this wasn't a good idea, right? You know, between 1996 and 2008, we built a prison every 10 days in this country. And we filled those prisons with predominantly black and brown people who aren't the majority drug users. You know, 36 million African Americans in this country, of a country of 360 million. So it was an issue that had a lot to do with race and the oppression and control of certain communities and the people living within those communities. So that's a benefit in itself if you're trying to make sure that the power, the money, the voter disenfranchisement, it has had, you know, as another form of incarceration, as far as we're concerned, voter disenfranchisement for a felony conviction. You know, 6 million black men could not vote in this last election that elected Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So it's real for the communities that need to fight for the change and need people to vote and to put people in office who will do that fight for us. We are now at a complete disadvantage as a result of felony disenfranchisement laws. So who's winning and who's losing? It's more than money. Some of it is money. You know, private prison industries exist. All of the money that's made on commissaries and toilets and prison bunks and all the things that we don't think about, that even states spend money on that don't have private prisons, for instance. They still buy. There's an entire conference, again, the ACA has. And at that conference, there are vendors. There's all kinds of conferences for industries, there are podcast conferences and all kinds of things. And at all these conferences, there's always this big space at the conference where you can go in and you can see all the cutting edge stuff for whatever thing that you're gone to that conference for. Well, the same goes for prisons. There are billions and billions of dollars generated every single year incarcerating people and the products and the everything that the equipment and the everything that goes into that. It's a incredible business. I mean, just on prison incarcerating people alone, we spend $69 billion a year in this country. That's just to lock somebody up. That doesn't include the billions and billions and billions of dollars. And who else is benefiting? Companies that use prison labor. So prison labor is used like slave labor now. And you have jails and prisons that farm out their prison labor to private companies in this country right now, who won't give them a job. If somebody comes out of prison and goes and applies outside to these companies and says, you know, yeah, I got a conviction, but I work for you inside, they're not going to give you a job. They're going to ban the box on you.
Yeah.
Right. So there's all kinds of winners and losers, but mostly we're losing as people. We're losing as human beings. We're losing as a society. You know, we're losing the potential of the human potential of all of these people that we have just thrown away and decided they don't matter. All of their children that are traumatized and go through. We just had a huge press conference here in Massachusetts in support of alternatives to incarceration. And a pediatrician, 97 health organizations signed on and here in Massachusetts. And one of the pediatricians came to talk at this press conference because he wanted people to understand what he is seeing as a pediatrician who works in a predominantly Black community here in Boston, and the toll that incarceration of parents is having on the children that are his patients. It's painful. So when we talk about loss, the further harm that's caused and the loss of potential, and one of the things that struck me, which I always knew, but every time I hear it, it just breaks my heart, that these children, only because of the incarceration and their stress and their trauma around the incarceration of their parents and missing them and being separated from them and whatever their life has turned into as a result of a parent being missing in their lives, has completely disrupted their education.
Yeah.
Completely disrupted their education. And that breaks my heart, because I don't believe that with all the horrific kind of things that are going on in the environment right now, I think that it's going to be some germ that's gonna tiny little microscopic something. We need every child, whether they're in the PS something in Harlem or the Bronx or in the hills of the Appalachia, the mountains, every single child in this country deserves the best hands down education. Public education should be the best education that you can get. And every single child should have access to it, because we need our children to learn, to grow, and to save us.
Yeah.
Right? Right. And we now are destroying massive, massive numbers of children that we don't know which one of these kids is going to come up with the cure for something.
Right.
You know, we can't call that just because, you know, it's not necessarily going to be some wealthy kid going to an elite private school. We need every kid to be fully educated. And that's the loss. There's so much loss. It's the disruption of the lives, the economic disruption of the lives of people that they can never recover from the loss of income, you know, that just keeps a community just mired in poverty. That's a loss. That's a shame.
So you are the founder of Families for Justice as Healing. First of all, how did that group start? And also explain the name to us.
Oh, boy. Well, it started in Danbury in the prison, and we were hearing the uptick. We could, if you could afford to purchase one, you could buy a transistor, a little clear plastic, little square box that was a transistor radio that you could get these earbuds and you could listen to the radio if you could buy one on the commissary. And so I had this little thing, and I ran 5 miles a day on the track just to get out of the prison, to clear my head, to save, really, it saved my life. I didn't run. I wasn't a jogger before I went to prison. I hated working out. I really probably wasn't in the best shape of my life when I went to prison. But being in that prison, it was either getting the pill line like so many women did, just because they could not handle the grief of being separated from their children and a host of other things. So many women are receiving psychotropic drugs who are incarcerated, and there's a huge number of women who are already dealing with mental illness prior to their incarceration that come in with that mental illness that's not treated properly. So many, the pill line happens twice a day in prison, and it's long. They announce it over the loudspeaker, and women line up all the way down the hall to get their medication. So it was either a choice of getting on that pill line or figuring out how to keep myself sane and healthy. And I chose to go walk down on the track one day, and I just kept going down there every day and walking and walking and walking, and that turned into a 5 mile a day jog. And it's really saved my life and helped me to make it through that time. But while I was there, Alec had just been exposed, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the NPR did a story that was titled Alec Exposed. And Alec, if your listeners don't know, I would encourage them to learn about Alec. Alec is a far right organization that was architects of much of the hard on crime legislation and policy. So they convened these meetings. They were heavily funded by the Koch brothers and other far right ultra conservative folks with political ideology that was at the time focused on hard-on-crime policy, and they pushed and created, along with a number of corporations, to create these cookie-cutter pieces of legislation that they would then turn over to their legislator members, who were Republicans, who would take this and get it passed. And so much of the mandatory minimum sentencing, the stand your ground laws, the voter disenfranchisement laws, all of the gutting of public education, these laws were all crafted by this organization, ALEC, and convened with corporations and ultra-conservative Republicans that came together to get these things passed. And they did. They passed them throughout the states, and it got us to where we are. And so they got exposed. Somebody shared all of their emails and information. And it was a big, big, big story back in 2010. And so I said, you know what? We had already in the prison been talking about organizing ourselves. We were hearing this increased stories on NPR and on these and on the news about the states and other people talking about the need for criminal justice reform. And the one thing that we weren't hearing as we were sitting in this prison, crammed full, 200 women in the section I was in up the hill and 1,500 women down the hill in the other part of the prison, we weren't hearing the voices of the incarcerated women. We weren't hearing the gender-specific issues that we had, you know, the lack of feminine hygiene products, just to say the least. That was the least of our worries. But the strip searches, the inappropriate sexual contact, the inadequate reproductive health care that women were receiving, the shackling of women during labor and delivery, which the federal government had stopped. But it takes you a long time once from arrest, if you're held, it takes a long time between arrest and actually landing in whatever prison they're going to send you to. And many women throughout the course of their incarceration are transported all over the country because it's a federal system. They'll send you anywhere they want to send you. And during that transport, you can be shackled while pregnant. You can go into labor. You can be shackled. And so those laws, that the policies that were passed to not shackle women during labor and delivery, which many states still do, weren't adhered to by the people who were transporting incarcerated women. So there were all these things that we knew we needed to organize, the conspiracy law, the fact that everybody in that prison was there for a drug case and it was a conspiracy case and that they were sentenced based on a conspiracy law that made it so that they had to get the same time as the head guy in the conspiracy. And so all these things were terrible things that we were knowing as the women sitting in this prison that we needed to address, because we didn't hear any of the concerns about women even. It was almost as if women weren't even being incarcerated. And at the time, and still are, women are the fastest now growing incarceration population in the country. And so we decided we were going to organize ourselves. We sat around a picnic table, a handful of us in the prison. Organizing is not allowed in the prison. You can't organize. It's a major infraction. But we did, and I was able to teach and introduce different writings from political folks like Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore and some other people, Susan Rosenberg and some other people that had been in that prison prior, and started to let the women know that women that have gone before us organized themselves and they created change and we need to do the same thing. And so that's what we did. And then one of my students was a Native American woman named Vanessa, and she was graduating. I taught GED. I taught science, English, and English as a second language. And that was the other thing that really saved me. I felt like I had a purpose during my incarceration, and helping women to get their high school equivalency was important to me, and it was important to them. And I was happy to have the privilege to be able to do that while I was incarcerated. But the student, Vanessa, she handed me a book. She had graduated. It was an incredible, wonderful experience to watch her at the little graduation ceremony that we had. And she was so proud of that she got her GED, and she was leaving. She was finally, her sentence was up and she was going home to her babies. And she handed me a book and she said, I've had this book and this is where my people are originally from. She was at the time, I think, living in Detroit, but her people were from a tribe in Canada. And somebody in her family had sent her that book. And the name of the book was Justice as Healing. And it was a story that had been written by a federal prosecutor from Canada, who had been charged with the task of overseeing the criminal cases in reservations in Canada. And they were handled very differently than the Western courts and how our judicial system works. And they did it from a space of taking the offense off the table, and the members of their community would wrap their arms around this person and put them in a healing circle and tell them how much they are loved and how important they are and who they belong to and why who they are, remind them who they are. And the people that the harm was caused to were able to come and to express what that meant to them and how it felt and how they would hope that the person would help them to heal from that harm that they caused. And they would ask them, what else, what do you need to heal yourself? What can we do? And it was an incredible book, Justice as Healing. And I decided when Vanessa gave me that book, I said, you know, Vanessa, wait, that's what we're going to call our, we're going to call our organization Families for Justice as Healing. And we did. We named us ourselves in that prison. And when I was released in July of 2011, I brought that book and the organization, the work out with me. And I promised the sisters that I left behind that I would never forget them. It's an experience that I think about every single day. I couldn't forget it if I tried. And there were times when I wanted to forget because, not that I wanted to forget, but it was so painful that I wished that I could put this down. It felt like a burden because it was so very painful to remember. But that burden is an important one to bear. And shame on me to come home knowing what I witnessed and knowing everything else that I know and have access to. I have access to resources. I have access to people. I know how to navigate systems. I know how to get to a source, to get their attention, to have a conversation with them. You know, I'm a trained as a lawyer. You know, I have a lot of education. And shame on me if I didn't use that to correct what I consider outside of our environmental issues,
yeah.
Things like Standing Rock, right? And our environment and climate control. Outside of that, there is no more egregious issue affecting human beings as mass incarceration.
So you are doing things like promoting certain kinds of legislation. Tell us what you do, what kind of laws you're working to get passed and to overturn.
Well, our overall goal is both on our local work at Families for Justice Healing and our national work at the National Council is work to end incarceration of women and girls. And we mean that. We take that very seriously. And we know that incarcerating women and girls is not the answer. And so and we imagine a world without prisons. We challenge that concept to really take a look at what that could be every day. That's the work that we do. And so within doing that work, yes, some of the work that we do is to create model legislation. We draft the legislation such as the primary caretaker bill that creates alternatives to incarceration for people who are primary caretakers of dependent children. So, you know, we do this. We work to help legislators like Cory Booker and Senator Elizabeth Warren write things such as the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act. We do what we call bringing our experiences as the experts that we know that we are as directly affected people to the policy. We call it bringing the people to the policy. And that is something that is important because right now, still, and more it's happening because of the work that we've been doing and so many other directly affected and formerly incarcerated people who are no longer sitting at the sidelines. Our mantra is nothing about us without us, which means don't sit around a table talking about us and we're not representing ourselves at that table.
Yeah.
Because the things that you're coming up with aren't the things that necessarily are the best practice or the best policy. But we know what is because we have lived through these experiences. So that's the work that we do.
Bringing people to the table who actually have the experience really shouldn't be a novel concept. I think the person who wrote the foreword to your book calls it common sense. And yet we have judges who've never even met somebody except in the courtroom who've been to prison making huge decisions on behalf of people they really don't know, on behalf of communities they don't know. How can people, maybe people listening to this program right now, how can they help? What can we do?
Well, certainly you can get engaged on any number of levels. You don't have to be a person like me that eats, lives, and breathes this every single day, and this is my life. You don't have to be that extreme about it. You know, 10 phone calls to a legislator shakes them in their boots, right? And we hear this, whether it's on the federal level, talking to Congress people, or whether we're on the state level, talking to state reps and state senators. We hear the same things in state houses across the country over and over and over again. Nobody calls us. People aren't engaged. Yeah. And particularly if they do, they're calling about the rights of dogs to not be forced to fight each other. Not that that's not an important issue. I am a dog lover. Let me be clear about that. We have a dog that is our child. And animal cruelty is nothing. Cruelty toward any living being is nothing that I take lightly at all. However, these are the issues that, you know, and the environment, very, very important. I'm the daughter of an environmentalist who won an EPA award for his commitment to our community, his environmental commitment. So I get it. My point in saying all this is these are the issues that people, when they do call, are calling about. And most of it is because of the fear politics that has kind of been built in, ingrained in us, and also racism, right? Because we've targeted since the end of slavery, and Michelle Alexander laid this out for us in her book, The New Jim Crow. Yeah. She did one of the most scholarly pieces on the trajectory of the end of slavery and picking up criminalization to a person control black people in this country. And so, one, we've got to address that issue around this square on and say and work on the fact that racism contributes a lot to people not picking up the mantle and addressing this horrific issue of mass incarceration in this country. Now we are seeing, again, because of an opioid crisis that is deeply affecting white families, we're seeing now there's a higher reaction and response now to engagement around criminal justice reform, because these things are directly affecting the majority's lives now, a lot to do with the opioid crisis. So people need to get involved. And if you don't know what to do, one, we need money. We need people who are willing to donate, individual donors. $5 makes all the difference in the world when we literally have no money in our account. None of us receive still. I've been home for almost 6 years. I don't receive a full-time salary for the work that I do. I barely just started to receive a salary, and it's not a full-time salary by any means. You know, we're struggling, and to do this work and then to also have the resources and to be able to pay rent for office space and keep the internet on, you can support people that way. If you want to just be hands-off and, you know, you can write a check. If you want to get more engaged, there are all kinds of things. If you know about technology, come and say, I'll give 10 minutes to help people figure out their website, you know, or if you have a job that you can give a formerly incarcerated person. You know, there's so many stigmas that attach to us upon reentry, and there are so many barriers to getting back on our feet because people will not hire formerly incarcerated people. I mean, I could come up with something that a person could do till the end of the day, right? There are many things that people can do that some are up close and personal, and some you wouldn't even have to talk to anybody, but you could still be helping. So I would encourage people to call Families for Justice is Healing, or look us up, go to the website, justiceashealing.org, go to nationalcouncil.us. Those are the two websites. And we won't make you do something you don't want to do, but we're sure in the laundry list of things that need to be done that there's something on that list that you can check off.
Andrea James, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. This is always a great opportunity. We greatly appreciate folks like yourself who are willing to help us amplify our voices. So thank you.
Once again, if you want to know more about this work, you can go to justiceashealing.org and nationalcouncil.us. And as always, if you have any stories or comments or anything you'd like to share in response to what you hear on this show, please write to us, feedback@radiocafe.org. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.